Welcome to the Gren Zone. Dissecting dermatology differently. Here is your host, Dr. Logan Kolb.
Welcome back, everyone. We've got a really great episode today that will be relevant for providers across many specialties because we're talking about sarcoidosis, which can affect many organ systems, including, the skin. So anywhere from 25 to 35% of sarcoidosis patients will have cutaneous changes, and these cutaneous sarcoidosis changes can be the first sign of this potentially life-threatening disease in up to one-third of cases. Therefore, as a dermatology provider, you may be the one to make the diagnosis and thus will need to have an approach for a good H&P and know which sorts of labs to order, referrals to make, and what the treatment options are. This episode will cover it all with the help of Dr. Grumpy Pants. And we've got a lot to cover, so we'll do a quick review of our reaction patterns and throw in our disclaimer that this episode is meant for educational and informational purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, nor does it represent the views of Orange Park Medical Center, Olmsted Medical Center, or their affiliates. Our five reaction patterns are papulosquamous, eczematous, vascular, dermal, and vesiculobullous. We're covering the dermal disorders, which we are further breaking down into five subcategories, one being depositional disorders, two being inflammatory causes that we further subdivide based on the type of inflammatory cells present, which include histiocytic, lymphocytic, neutrophilic, eosinophilic, and mast cell disorders. We are currently going through the dermal histiocytic disorders, which include granuloma annulare, sarcoidosis, necrobiosis lipoidica, rheumatoid nodules, juvenile xanthogranulomas, Langerhans cell histiocytosis, leprosy, and tuberculosis. Then the third dermal subcategory are the infections. Four, we have proliferative lesions such as dermatofibromas. Then fifth, we have the subcutaneous disorders such as erythema nodosum that we'll also discuss a bit today.
So what in tarnation is sarcoidosis?
Sarcoidosis is a condition where these pesky histiocytes we've been discussing start making non-caseating granulomas, often diffusely in the body. And what does non-caseating actually mean? Well, caseating literally means turning into cheese and refers to granulomas seen in tuberculosis and other conditions where destruction of cells leads to an amorphous cheesy substance at the center of a granuloma. The non-caseating granulomas seen in sarcoidosis, on the other hand, do not exhibit this cheesy destruction. For sarcoidosis patients, non-caseating granulomas most commonly show up in the lungs and hilar lymph nodes, but they can impact pretty much any organ system, including the eyes, heart, and CNS. So, let's talk about the involvement of these other organs before we get to the skin. Sarcoidosis affects the lungs in 90 to 95% of cases. It can vary from mild disease, where over half of patients get bilateral hilar lymphadenopathy without symptoms, all the way to severe lung disease with irreversible scarring of the lungs and pulmonary hypertension. Sarcoidosis also involves the eyes in at least 10% of cases, unless the patient is Japanese, for whom over half of patients will have ocular involvement. Eye involvement ranges from anterior uveitis in about two-thirds of patients to more severe involvement with optic neuritis that can progress to permanent vision changes. Besides uveitis, sarcoidosis can also cause granulomas of the conjunctiva or any other part of the eye, including the lacrimal glands leading to dry eyes. Sarcoidosis can also affect the heart, which, like ocular sarcoid, is most likely to occur in Japanese patients. Cardiac sarcoidosis affects at least 5% of patients where granulomatous deposits in the heart affect its electrical conduction or function. Cardiac sarcoidosis can vary from asymptomatic EKG changes to AV or bundle branch blocks, VTAC, CHF, and sudden death. Granulomas from sarcoidosis can also develop in the nervous system in 5 to 15% of patients, with cranial nerve involvement being most common and leading to changes such as Bell's palsy seen in Heerfurth syndrome that we'll discuss later on. And besides involving the lungs, lymph nodes, skin, eyes, heart, and nervous system, just know that sarcoidosis can also affect other organs like the kidneys, liver in at least 10% of patients, spleen in 10 to 50% of patients, joints including the ankles in up to 40% of patients, and less commonly the upper airways, muscles, and bones.
Before we talk skin, let's talk pathogenesis. The patients will not only ask you what is sarcoidosis, but also why they've got it. Why them? Will it spread to their cat? When will it go away, and will frequent perineal sunning improve the cure rate? What are you going to tell them? That they are hopeless, ridiculous, spoiled, rotten, selfish Googlers that should shut their mouth and listen for once? No, I think you'll tone it down a bit, or you'll have an empty waiting room.
Like many things in medicine, we don't know exactly what causes sarcoidosis. But what we do know is that sarcoidosis tends to start in the winter and spring. Therefore, we think there could be some type of infectious or environmental trigger that sets off the immune system to make these granulomas. So, who gets sarcoidosis? It most commonly affects women and African American patients, with the onset of disease usually in patients' 20s or 30s. And why do patients get it? Most likely three factors. 1, genetics. 2, possible environmental or infectious antigens. And 3, an altered immune response. What we think is that a genetically susceptible person with certain HLA markers gets exposed to an environmental or infectious antigen. The antigen gets presented by an antigen-presenting cell, leading to a dysregulated Th1 response that results in non-caseating granulomas in a variety of tissues.
Now hold on a minute now, Doc. Back up. What was that? Something about a case of granulomas? I'd rather have a case of beer than a case of granulomas.
We know genetics plays a role due to familial cases and findings of twin studies, but what is probably most important to know are the possible culprit infectious and environmental antigens. Mycobacteria is the most suspicious, since it has been detected in sarcoid lesions but not from normal tissue. Other possibilities include a variety of other microbes such as P. acnes, herpes viruses, Epstein-Barr virus, or Borrelia. Possible environmental triggers include mold, mildew, and industrial organic dust. There are also reports of sarcoidosis caused by a variety of medications, including heart therapy for HIV patients, interferon or ribavirin treatments for hep C, or paradoxically by the TNF-alpha inhibitors, which we typically think of as busting up granulomas, not forming them. So again, remember to explain to sarcoid patients that number one, there is likely a genetic predisposition. Number two, a variety of possible antigens set off the immune system, including Mycobacterium, HSV, EBV, mold, mildew, industrial organic dust, or meds like heart therapy. Then number three, the immune system starts forming persistent pockets of inflammation called non-caseating granulomas. As for prognosis, over 60% of patients will have resolution of their sarcoid without residual problems in 2 to 5 years, whereas it becomes chronic or progresses to fibrosis in 10 to 30% of cases.
Not an entirely awful review, I might venture to say you are improving. Tell me about the cutaneous manifestations of sarcoidosis.
We break the skin changes into two groups, one being specific sarcoid lesions with non-caseating granulomas, which occur in 9 to 15% of patients, and two non-specific lesions that are a reactive process, such as erythema nodosum seen in up to 25% of patients. Sarcoidosis is often called the great imitator because it has a big, big list of possible presentations in the skin, from the common papules and plaques to the rarely seen sarcoidal alopecia. The variety of presentations may be due to the variety of contributing antigens, or variation in patients' immune response to these antigens. Regardless, we as dermatology providers need to know how sarcoidosis impacts the skin, which will break into three groups: the common, uncommon, and rare presentations. Common presentations include the three Ps with papules, plaques, or lupus pernio, along with subcutaneous sarcoid, sarcoid within scars, or the nonspecific erythema nodosum lesions. Uncommon presentations include annular, atrophic, ulcerative, hypopigmented, psoriasiform, and mucosal sarcoid, while rare presentations include lichenoid, verrucous, photodistributed, erythrodermic, polymorphous, nail sarcoid, and sarcoidal alopecia. We'll hit the highlights of the common presentations before we mention the uncommon and rare presentations one more time. As for common presentations, remember that papular sarcoidosis favors the face and usually resolves without scarring. Plaque sarcoidosis, on the other hand, tends to be chronic and also favors the face, along with the back, butt, and extensors. There can also be maculopapular sarcoid anywhere on the body, which is associated with systemic involvement but otherwise has a good prognosis. Around 80% of maculopapular sarcoid resolves in 2 years, whereas 90% of plaque sarcoid is persistent at 2 years. The next common sarcoidosis presentation that you've got to know well is lupus pernio. It presents with violaceous plaques in a malar distribution on the nose and cheeks. Unlike the acute nature of the malar rash of SLE, the plaques of lupus pernio tend to be chronic. They can also become quite extensive and mimic Wegener's granulomatosis or lymphomas that cause nasal ulcerations and perforation of the nasal septum. Lupus pernio patients can also have lung involvement in around 75% of cases, upper respiratory, bone, or reticuloendothelial involvement in 50% of cases, and eye involvement in 1/3 of lupus pernio cases. So that covers the more popular sarcoidosis skin changes, the three Ps, with papules that tend to be acute and self-limited, plaques that tend to be chronic, and lupus pernio, which also tends to be chronic and systemic. The last three more common presentations we'll discuss are subcutaneous sarcoid, sarcoid in scars, and the reactive erythema nodosum lesions. Subcutaneous sarcoidosis, also called the Derrière-Roussy form, presents with fleshy nodules usually up to 2 centimeters in size that favor the arms over the legs. They are usually not inflamed and are non-tender, which helps differentiate them from the tender and inflamed erythema nodosum lesions on the legs that we'll discuss in a minute. Next, there is scar sarcoidosis, where patients present with papules within a scar or tattoo.
Okay, now what else is on your differential for papules within a tattoo?
When a papule or lesion develops within a tattoo, you'll want to consider sarcoidosis, granulomatous foreign body reaction, allergic contact dermatitis, infections such as atypical mycobacterium, and keratoacanthomas. Again, for a papule or lesion that develops within a tattoo, you'll want to consider sarcoidosis, granulomatous foreign body reactions, allergic contact dermatitis, infections such as atypical mycobacterium, and keratoacanthomas. But let's get back to common sarcoid lesions. Don't forget about erythema nodosum, seen in 25% of sarcoidosis cases, which are reactive skin lesions that are nonspecific and do not contain non-caseating granulomas seen in sarcoid-specific lesions. Erythema nodosum presents as erythematous, tender, sub-Q nodules and plaques that are usually around a few centimeters in width. Erythema nodosum is more often seen in sarcoidosis patients who are of Scandinavian descent and usually seen with Lofgren syndrome.
Okay, I've got a little game you're going to want to play if you ever want to pass your boards and also not sound like a moron. I name the sarcoidosis variant and you give the clinical features. Lofgren syndrome.
Lofgren syndrome patients present with fevers, iritis, arthritis, hilar adenopathy, and erythema nodosum. Again, Lofgren syndrome is a relatively common presentation of acute sarcoidosis with fevers, iritis, arthritis, hilar adenopathy, and erythema nodosum. Remember that iritis, aka anterior uveitis, represents inflammation of the iris and can present with red eye, eye pain, photophobia, or vision change. Although it's acute, Lofgren syndrome tends to have a good prognosis, with 80% of cases resolving spontaneously in 2 years.
Ah, but did you say Lofgren syndrome or Loeffler syndrome?
Lofgren syndrome is this acute presentation of sarcoidosis. Loeffler syndrome is an eosinophilic lung disease. So here's a pro tip. Lofgren syndrome has a G in it to help you remember the granulomas of sarcoidosis.
Okay, back to sarcoid. How about lupus pernio?
Lupus pernio consists of violaceous papules and plaques on the nose, cheeks, and the ears that leave scars and has a poor prognosis.
Ooh, another name game. What are some of the other conditions in dermatology that contain the word lupus?
Remember, lupus pernio is a form of sarcoidosis with violaceous papules and plaques on the nose, cheeks, and the ears that leave scars and has a poor prognosis. Lupus erythematosus is the autoimmune condition that we all think of when we hear lupus. Then there's lupus vulgaris, which is a form of cutaneous tuberculosis where patients have contiguous or hematologic spread of TB to the skin of the head and neck, forming red-brown papules and plaques. And lastly, lupus miliaris disseminatus facii is a rare condition with red-brown granulomatous papules on the face that some people propose is a variant of granulomatous rosacea, sarcoidosis, or even cutaneous tuberculosis.
Forget I even asked. Let's get back on track. Stay on target. Tell me about Heerfordt syndrome.
Heerfordt syndrome, aka uveoparotid fever, is a less common sarcoidosis presentation that consists of fevers, parotid gland enlargement, facial nerve palsy, and uveitis. Think of the parotid gland in front of the ear when you see Heerfordt syndrome, which again has parotid gland enlargement affecting the nearby facial nerve leading to a Bell's palsy and also having fevers and uveitis. And what is uveitis? Inflammation of the uvea, which contains the iris we just discussed, along with the ciliary body and or the choroid plexus. Remember, uveitis presents with pain, light sensitivity, blurry vision, and redness. Untreated uveitis is a leading cause of blindness, so it's crucial to get it evaluated and treated promptly.
What is that common and most repulsive of anecdotes you young people are throwing around these days? Place your hands in the air, shake your derriere. What about derriere russi sarcoidosis?
This is the subcutaneous form of sarcoidosis where patients often have multiple painless nodules and hilar lymphadenopathy. All right, so before we jump into the systemic changes of sarcoidosis, let's briefly mention those uncommon and rare cutaneous sarcoidosis presentations one more time, which are thankfully pretty descriptive. Uncommon presentations include annular, atrophic, ulcerative, hypopigmented, psoriasiform, and mucosal sarcoid, while the rare presentations include lichenoid, verrucous, photodistributed, erythrodermic, polymorphous, nail sarcoid, and sarcoidal alopecia. So here's some quick snippets on a few of these. Ulcerative sarcoidosis is seen in up to 5% of cutaneous sarcoidosis cases, is often seen in systemic sarcoid cases, and tends to develop on the shin. Ulcerative sarcoid also tends to develop within atrophic sarcoid lesions that mimic necrobiosis lipoidica. Verrucous sarcoid has the look of warts or lichen simplex chronicus, or LSC, and tends to appear in areas of friction, such as the intertriginous areas. Mucosal sarcoidosis most often affects the nose and lips, and sarcoidosis of the nail has a wide variety of findings, including subungual hyperkeratosis and other findings that mimic nail psoriasis, such as pitting, onycholysis, and dactylitis.
Dermatologists often make the diagnosis of sarcoidosis when we biopsy a skin lesion and look at the clinical and histologic appearance with our pathologist to rule out other causes of granulomas such as tuberculosis, leprosy, or non-infectious causes like beryllium or zirconium exposures. And like any skin disease, we must be well informed on how it affects the patient internally. So what organ systems are possibly affected outside of the skin, and what do you then do about it? And don't stop there. How are you going to treat their skin disease? Because after all, this is why they are in your office.
When seeing your sarcoidosis patient, a good thorough review of systems should be done to check for involvement of all those systems we discussed. Ask about constitutional symptoms, along with eye, lung, cardiac, or neurologic involvement especially. For the management of sarcoidosis, patients will need to be seen by a pulmonologist and ophthalmologist, along with having a PCP who can direct the ship, as there can be other specialists that need to be involved depending on which organs are affected. Remember that at least 10% of patients have eye involvement. Two-thirds of the time, that consists of anterior uveitis, which may not have symptoms in one-third of cases, even though it still has the potential to cause serious eye damage. This is why all sarcoidosis patients need a slit lamp exam with an ophthalmologist at least yearly. Labs also need to be done at least yearly to check for systemic involvement, including a CBC, CMP, and UA. The CBC checks for anemia, lymphopenia, and pancytopenia, which together can occur in 30% of patients, while the CMP and UA check for kidney and liver involvement, along with the calcium levels that we'll discuss in a minute. Some providers will also check levels of angiotensin converting enzyme, aka ACE, which are elevated in 60% of patients. ACE is made by the epithelioid cells in the granuloma. However, it is nonspecific and can't be used for the diagnosis or determining prognosis in patients. It is only suggestive. Besides the CBC, CMP, UA, and ACE levels, all patients need a chest x-ray and pulmonary function tests on an annual basis as well, even if symptoms aren't present. Also, don't forget about cardiac involvement in at least 5% of patients. Therefore, some recommend EKG in all patients, while others either rely on a good review of systems or other imaging such as echocardiograms or 24-hour Holter monitors. Before we discuss sarcoid treatment, I want to take a quick aside and discuss calcium abnormalities. The activated macrophages in sarcoidosis convert 25-hydroxy vitamin D to the active 1,25-dihydroxy vitamin D. And as you know, active vitamin D increases calcium absorption in the gut. Therefore, around 10% of patients will have high serum calcium levels, and around 50% can have elevated calcium levels in their urine. Again, remember, macrophages in sarcoidosis convert 25-hydroxy vitamin D to the active 1,25-dihydroxy vitamin D. Also keep in mind that the 25-hydroxy is what we measure to check patients' vitamin D levels. Therefore, it can appear low since it is being converted. But you should not give more vitamin D to correct this, because obviously that will lead to even higher calcium levels and potential kidney stones or renal failure.
Okay, so treatment options. Anybody? Anybody?
When it comes to treatment of sarcoidosis, the basic premise is suppressing the immune system, since remember that it is these histiocytes that are creating the non-caseating granulomas that are causing the disease. There is a long list of treatments we'll go through, but please keep in mind that there are very few double-blinded randomized trials for these treatments, so we have weak evidence to support them. But we need to start somewhere. So, for treating skin involvement that is mild or limited, strong topical steroids or intralesional steroids are often tried first. This can be done with clobetasol or halobetasol applied twice weekly under occlusion, or with intralesional triamcinolone ranging in strength from 3 to 20 milligrams per cc injected every 3 to 4 weeks. Oftentimes, the topical or intralesional steroids are combined with minocycline 100 mg twice daily, which has been helpful in small studies, likely due to immunomodulatory effects. When the topical or intralesional steroids or minocycline aren't cutting it, or if disease is more extensive or disfiguring, that's when we turn to antimalarials, systemic steroids, methotrexate, other steroid-sparing agents, or the TNF-alpha inhibitors adalimumab or infliximab. Antimalarials used for sarcoidosis include hydroxychloroquine dosed at 200 mg once to twice daily, or chloroquine at 250 to 750 mg daily. Hydroxychloroquine, aka Plaquenil, is much less likely to cause corneal deposits and retinopathy. However, straight-up chloroquine has a little more evidence for efficacy and is especially helpful for lupus pernio. Systemic steroids like prednisone are often the mainstay for generalized or systemic disease, dosed at 0.5 to 1 mg per kg initially for the first 1 to 3 months until patients are responding well. It is then gradually tapered to the smallest dose possible, and if you can't get that dose below 10 mg a day, that is often where the steroid-sparing agents like methotrexate come in. Methotrexate is dosed anywhere from 5 to 25 mg a week, and may take up to 6 months to take effect. It's also important to know that patients will often relapse when these systemic agents such as minocycline, the antimalarials, prednisone, or methotrexate are discontinued. And when patients aren't responding to these agents, that's when we reach for TNF-alpha blocking medications such as adalimumab, infliximab, or thalidomide, which can be quite effective since they block the TNF-alpha cytokine signal that helps form and maintain these sarcoidal granulomas. All right, so that's what we got for content today. Let's hit a quick music break before we close out with a summary. Sarcoidosis occurs in genetically predisposed patients who encounter a possible antigen, including Mycobacterium, HSV, EBV, mold, mildew, industrial organic dust, or meds like heart therapy, which sets off the formation of non-caseating granulomas. These granulomas most commonly show up in the lungs and hilar lymph nodes, but they can impact pretty much any organ systems, including the eyes, heart, and CNS. Specific sarcoid lesions occur in 9 to 15% of patients, while non-specific lesions like erythema nodosum are seen in up to 25% of patients. Common presentations include the three Ps with papules, plaques, or lupus pernio, along with subcutaneous sarcoid, sarcoid within scars, or the nonspecific erythema nodosum lesions. Uncommon presentations include annular, atrophic, ulcerative, hypopigmented, psoriasiform, and mucosal sarcoid, while rare presentations include lichenoid, verrucous, photodistributed, erythrodermic, polymorphous, nail sarcoid, and sarcoidal alopecia. All patients need to be seen by an ophthalmologist and a pulmonologist. Labs include CBC, CMP, UA, ACE levels, and quantiferon gold to rule out tuberculosis, while treatment options include topical, intralesional, or systemic steroids, tetracycline antibiotics, antimalarials, methotrexate or other steroid-sparing agents, and finally the TNF-alpha inhibitors adalimumab or infliximab. All right, thanks for joining today. I want to thank Dr. Sean for his help with the content and Dr. K for not only adding clinical pearls but supporting this podcast from the get-go. I also want to thank Garrett and Dan for their work with editing and post-production, along with our excellent team of students and residents with Dave, Dan, and Sandra, who put together an awesome study guide for each episode that's available at www.grenzonederm.com. And that's with two Z's, grenzonederm.com. If you have any feedback on how we can improve our content, you can contact us through our website or via email at grenzonederm@gmail.com. Also, don't forget to follow us on social media for more helpful mnemonics and quiz questions. Thanks again for listening today. I'm Logan Kolb, and we'll see you next time here in the Gren Zone.
This episode is copyright 2021 Pro Podcasting LLC, all rights reserved. The Gren Zone podcast is a service provided by Pro Podcasting LLC and is not affiliated with any other service providers.